Hi, this is Janie Reisner, and welcome once again to Women's Voices. I have a special show tonight. Max Dashue, independent and dedicated scholar of global women's history and cultural studies, founder of the Suppressed Histories Archives, is my guest. And here is the audio from the trailer of her recent double DVD, Women Shaman, The Ancients.
When women are left out of discussions of world religions, it is not because no cultural record exists of female spiritual leadership. Far from it. Woman Shaman, The Ancients, provides a global survey of medicine women as depicted in rock art, sculpture, paintings, bronzes, and ceramics. With commentary and archival world music from Smithsonian folkways and dozens of contemporary musicians. This visually stunning video retrieves archaeological treasures from obscurity to reveal a rich and mostly unseen female past. It foregrounds ceremony depicted in the great stone galleries of the Sahara, of southern Africa, from Namibia to South Africa to Zimbabwe, the rock paintings of Spain, Australia, and Baja California. Women are shown dancing with tigers on Indus seals, with serpents on Iranian ones, and with lions in Zimbabwe. They dance and chant in ecstatic ceremonies on Chinese bronzes, Cretan seals, and Aztec codices. Female shapeshifters manifest walrus tusks in Alaska and horns in Libya. In ceramic sculptures from Ecuador, they transform with snakes. In Peru, they become owls. In Nicaragua, deer. This double disc DVD shows the 2,000-year-old mask of the Siberian medicine woman of Ekvin, the Mesolithic regalia of the Bad Dürrenberg shaman in Germany, the tree of life crowns of Ak Alaha in the Altai, and Tilya Tepe in Afghanistan, and the horned gold crown of the priestess of Kao in Peru. Female ceremonial leaders are painted on the vessels of pre-dynastic Egypt, sculptured in the ceramics of Veracruz, Mexico, and Moravia in Central Europe, in numerous Haniwa of Japan, and in lesser-known pieces from Turkmenistan. They also appear in bronzes from China and from Benin in Nigeria, in pagan Russian silver and Colombian gold. Woman Shaman, The Ancients, addresses the gaping omission of women in most accounts of ancient history and religion. It overturns the presumption that archaic shamanism was a masculine preserve. The video explores recurring patterns and themes. Staves and wands. Rattles, clappers, and bells. drums, and incantation. Ceremonial fans and herb bundles. Ritual ties and body paint. And sacred mirrors. This video recalls into cultural memory women's ecstatic dance, their healing and herbal wisdom, their divination and auguries, dreaming and visions, and their prophecy. A rich cultural record becomes visible again of medicine women, invocators, ceremonial leaders, and seers, of those ancient women who journeyed in the spirit.
Oh, wow, that is just wonderful music, isn't it? End of story. For more than 44 years, Max Dashew has researched and documented global women's history and cultural studies. She founded the Suppressed Histories Archives in 1970 as an independent scholar and began presenting women's history slideshows in 1973. Her legendary archives hold over 15,000 slides, with tens of thousands more images in digital format, as well as print photos or photocopies. Max has created 150 visual talks. The rest are international surveys of subjects such as female rebels and mavericks, mother right and gender justice, treasures of African women, Asian women shamans, patriarchies, racism, history, and lies. Max has taken her visual talks around the U.S. and many other countries around the world. She has produced two videos, Women's Power in Global Perspective in 2008 and Women Shaman, the Ancients in 2013. Her next publication will be the first book in her multi-volume series, Secret History of the Witches, about women in European history, folk tradition, and the witch hunts. She clearly shows that once upon a time, women were heralded and honored as queens and women of greatness and power. In the fall of 1969, in the midst of an anti-war movement, with the ascent of women's liberation, Max Dashew left behind a full scholarship at Rutgers to begin research as an independent scholar on global women's history, mother right, patriarchy, and the origins of domination. Women's studies did not yet exist. Women's history was literally treated as a joke, and the academic climate was hostile to raising questions about women's status and the suppression of female power. Dashew began scouring libraries for evidence of women's leadership and other social patterns that fell outside the claimed universality of male domination. She focused on the missing center of women from a global perspective, seeking to understand how domination worked in terms of gender, class, and ethnicity. She intuited that the broadest expressions of female leadership were retained in the indigenous world, among the same cultures that had been disregarded and disparaged by classical scholarship, and this proved out. Women leadership often crossed the boundaries of political, religious, economic, and artistic spheres as laid down in the classic Western civ worldview. This pattern was one of many pointers toward a different cultural paradigm, and it is the oral histories of the Aboriginal peoples that provide the substance of these suppressed histories and flesh out women's contributions and spheres of power. Dashew's research in archaeology showed that Neolithic iconography overwhelmingly emphasized women in a qualitatively different way than modern media. She found that women in indigenous societies typically had more freedom than women in feudal and colonial systems, and that all present-day matrilineages occur in indigenous societies. Abundant indicators showed that male domination of women correlated with domination by class, ethnicity, and other socio-political hierarchies. Historical patterns emerged of upper classes being more invested in patrilineage, multiple wives, and constraining women's bodies and behavior than commoners or indigenous peoples. That is why the Romans called the ruling class patricians, why veiling and female seclusion began with the Indo-European elite, and why foot binding and corsets began with aristocrats, long before these customs spread to other classes and cultures. Dashiell found that the public female spheres of power tended to concentrate in areas of spiritual leadership, and conversely, that banning the priestess was a keystone to deepening the cultural colonization of women through religion. A more profound level of domination was possible than could be achieved through violence and coercion if only women could be induced to believe that their oppression was divinely ordained, and to acquiesce to an idolatry of the masculine and all male religious authorities. Max has spent her life researching what was swept away, ignored, or distorted, says Chris Welch of KPFA. Megan Morgan asked when interviewing Max, "What is the reason that women were removed from historical awareness?" Max replies, "Multiple reasons. To sustain the idea that men are naturally superior, all evidence to the contrary must be removed. Disdain for women leading to the belief that females could not have mattered or done anything significant, and thus evidence disproving that is ignored or regarded as insignificant. And male dominant systems would have to change if women knew their real history, that we are not doomed to be dominated, and that patriarchy is not the human default. Showing that is seen as a threat." And welcome, Max, to KZYX.
Thank you, Janie.
Good to have you here.
I'm glad to be on.
The first question I ask is, what part did your mother play in your becoming the woman that you are today?
My mother was a good mom. She was a good nurturer. She made a sweet home for us. She encouraged our artistic ability. She helped us to get educated, you know, encouraged us to get educated. And so, you know, that was a stable way to start out in the world. And, you know, that was my launching pad.
Well, that's wonderful. What were the pivotal moments in those growing up years that set the stage for who you are now? And also, I think you told me that you knew that you would have to, or in order to go to college, you would have to get a scholarship. So there was that.
Yeah, I started working hard in high school. You know, I kind of woke up. My parents sat us down and said, you know, if you want to go to college, then you have to get a scholarship because we can't pay for it. So I knew that going in, and I just started to really work for the grades and do all the other things that you have to do. And in those days, they had better scholarships than now. So that was, you know, a plus at that time. And so I did. I won a full scholarship. By the way, that was to Radcliffe, a.k.a. Harvard, not Rutgers.
Sorry.
It's okay.
It's a little different.
So, you know, it was, and that was a big change for me because I was a small-town girl from Illinois. I had never been anywhere else, really.
Yeah, that's, you know? Yes.
And all of a sudden to shift out to the other coast and, you know, whole other world there, boy. I didn't know what I was getting into.
Well, I can imagine.
Ivy Leaguers, prep school kids.
Oof. Oh, right. You know, I'm from Illinois, too, and grew up from even in a smaller town than you, and I went to Monmouth College, which was 10 miles from my home, but there were students there from Chicago who were very, you know, polished, and I just felt like I stumbled in the wrong place.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's kind of that cultural fish out of the water. It's culture shock. Mm-hmm. I went through culture shock, but I didn't know what that was at that time. I mean, you know, it was just it was kind of in that situation, the onus is on you. What's wrong with you that you know haven't been to Europe and done all these things, right?
Right.
So, you know, I mean, class and culture shock because of class as well as other factors.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, what prompted you, what pointed you in the direction of matriarchal studies and history?
I was in college and taking anthropology, and they introduced the subject of matrilineal societies only to disprove the idea that there could ever be any other model of human society than male dominance. They brought it up. They said, okay, these exist, but it doesn't mean anything. Don't even look there. This is not, you know, this is not for you. It doesn't count. And I was like, matrilineal societies. You know, that was something that I just really thought, I got to know more about this. I actually didn't believe them, you know, that it meant that the societies would still have to be male-dominated, because this was just a totally different idea that I had never heard of it. Why had I never heard of it? Until now, at the age of 18, right? And so I began researching that. And that was also, in 1969, it was really just politically, you remember, the world was blowing up. There was all this, you know, the protest movements were at their absolute height, the anti-Vietnam War movement. I was involved in activism. The Harvard strike happened the year that I went, my first year that I went to college. And so, you know, there was a lot of ferment going on that really affected me. And so I wound up actually deciding that I was not going to be able to pursue my subject. The professors all, you know, had their absolute idea about what they thought about this. And, you know, you get graded down if you say things they disagree with. And I just felt like, well, what am I doing here? You know, I want to know about this. I want to know about women, where women stand in the world, you know, not only in matrilineal societies, but I wanted to understand patriarchy. And are there societies that are not patriarchal? Are there women that are free? And so I decided to begin researching that as an independent scholar.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I did. And I still have my library card at at Harvard, you know, and actually Radcliffe. And so I would just go in there and begin researching and looking to see if I could find any other social patterns than the ones that I had been shown all my life and the ones that the professors were insisting on, that, you know, males over females, you know, males more prestigious, women submissive, all of those doctrines. And so that involves, of course, a great deal of research to get down into the nitty-gritty of that. But one of the intuitions I had is that if I was going to find sex egalitarian societies, that I was going to find them in the indigenous world. And so that's where I began to look. But also, I really needed to learn world history as a whole, even to understand, well, where are the indigenous peoples? Where should I look? You know, where are the what societies are patriarchal? What is the history of legal repression of women, of religious repression, of political structures that, you know. And so I needed to really do a massive self-education, which, you know, I had already gotten a fairly good start. I got a pretty good education in my high school, such as, you know, you get in American schools. And so, but I needed to really look at a lot of factors. I knew that. Because it's very tempting, and I see a lot of people doing this today, to think there's just one thing, and if we just fix that one thing, everything will be okay. Well, you know, there's so many axes of oppression. You know, you have settler cultures versus Aboriginal societies. You have class systems and slavery. You certainly have male over female. That's a very big global reality, and it has been for a long time. But, you know, there's all these different levels and layers and interactions. So, you know, I felt like it was really important to look at all of those and see how they interact.
Wow. It's amazing that you knew what patriarchy was. I mean, you were in the middle of it, but it hasn't been on my, you know, in front of me, except for the last 20 years. Wow.
Well, you know, here's one of the things in the New Left, which I was involved in, you know, opposing the Vietnam War and looking at the oppression of black people in the United States, of Native Americans. You know, I was very much, I could see those injustices very clearly. And I'd always been conscious as a girl that the ways that boys were favored and the ways that girls were restricted and even despised, I mean, now a lot of that got through to me, but it really slammed into me full force in college. And, you know, the way that things happened at meetings in the anti-war movement. And, you know, this is a famous thing. Women would stand up and say something, and she'd be completely ignored. And then some guy would stand up and say the same thing. Oh, what a great idea. Let's do that.
Uh-huh.
You know, and it was like the invisibility and the unhearability of women and the failure to pick up on female leadership. And really the contempt for women and the passing around of basically concubines between, you know, some of the honcho leaders, you know, the men in the bomber jackets, and just the conditional nature of female participation, really conditional on how they related to important men, you know, or mm-hmm. whether they did it all, that really made me see how deep patriarchy went. I mean, there were a lot of life experiences I had in that time span that made it really clear to me that there was a really severe problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to understand why and how and, you know, if things had been different. I mean, I just really did not feel like this, the level of injustice that I was seeing in the world could be an absolute historically. You know, it just seemed like there had to be something else. And mm-hmm. it's just like when you're in the sea, you don't smell the sea. You know, it's all around right. you, you're just in it. And I kind of felt like that was probably my situation, our situation.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so I wanted to understand it. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was really the impetus for my research.
Mm-hmm. I want to interrupt you and say you're listening to Max Dashew. Am I pronouncing your last name?
Dashew, yeah.
Dashew. Creator of the Suppressed Women's Archives.
Suppressed Histories Archive.
Thank you. Yes. You know, that's reminiscent. When you're speaking about how did this begin, this certainly it hasn't always been this way. And I know that I've felt that way, and I know that I can remember my son saying, I mean, he was in first or second or third grade, and he remembered, and then he recounted it to me later, of just sitting there and realizing things aren't supposed to be this way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the alienation from the heart, all yeah. of that, that is so...
And children know it. They see it.
You bet. You bet. Mm-hmm. I remember when my grandson started kindergarten. I said, and I just thought it was awful. I said to you, how is it? And he said, we only get to 15 minutes to play outside.
Yeah.
And that's it. Our mothers know better. I have a question, and this may be jumping into it, about mother right and the origins of domination. You know, I realized as you mentioned that domination doesn't come with the territory, right? It has to be mm-hmm. learned mostly from being dominated.
Yeah. See, the way I'm looking at this is that I think patriarchy or male domination is not the human default.
Right.
I see it as a set of historical layers or even processes, things that develop and they just kind of pile up into the culture. They get loaded in, and then they get embedded, you know, like viruses, and they spread. But those toxic memes of, you know, female inferiority, of all of this stuff, get loaded into culture, and then they're like programs that inculcate values and behaviors and privileges and obligations. You know, male privilege, female obedience, getting all of that, the idea that is so prevalent in current U.S. culture that women's value is in how they look and that they have to perform for men, that that's, you know, how you get a partner, that's your worth. If you don't look good, whatever that is defined as being, then you're worthless, and that means literally worthless in the marketplace, not just even in the relationship thing. Mm-hmm. And so there's all these ways that culture dictates without most people ever being conscious of the ways they are being conditioned and pressured and even coerced by culture, you know. And so we have to look at the origins of, you know, we can look at the history of patriarchal religions. Certainly that's a big way of transmitting those ideas and really making women feel from inside, because they have this in with their mother's milk, you know, with their Sunday school or whatever it is that they're getting, that, you know, that female is less, that they should be afraid of the divine, you know, that they'll be punished, that all of the hell stuff is going on, and that, you know, men are naturally over them, and that the divine is male, and on and on. You know, a lot of sexual shame scripts are taught. And so these are all embedded in culture, and we have now the mass media, which is, and you know, online porn and all these things, which are really transmitting very powerful messages, which most people aren't really looking at analytically. They are just seeing that as what is, you know. So you have to be able to look at it in and trace things back to their origins. I think that's really important. You know, tracing back to origins, the idea of male lordship, which we can see in a lot of Bronze Age societies. And, you know, just many, many examples. Interfering with women's bodies, you know, amputation of body parts or binding or seclusion. You know, there's all these ways of restraining and constricting females. And what is the purpose, ultimately? It is to enforce a sexual double standard that upholds male authority, patrilineage, the necessity to identify who is the father, who a woman belongs to, who she's owned by, controlled by. And even in modern U.S. society, I think that it's hard for a lot of women to see those roots, because they can't make the connection between, you know, the movie they just saw and the themes of males overwhelming females that come up so often in media, with these much older things that have to do with marriage by capture and rape and the enslavement of captives and all of these, and servile marriage, which is an interesting name. Not that any marriage has to be a domination relationship, but in a lot of cultures there are codes that demand that females be subjugated and submissive, and, you know, that the male is their lord.
What a lot of energy over the centuries has been put out by men to subjugate women. It's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, and then we've got this other factor, which is the fact that women's power and economic well-being and safety are all contingent. And so then you get women leveraging their lesser position, but trying to get a little higher up. And so the way they do that is on other women. And so you've got female collusion, because they can get a little bit out of it, you know, or maybe it's just getting their children above the children of the other wife, or, you know, whatever it is, of the slave, you know. And so you have this divide and conquer dynamic, which we can also see in the conquest of indigenous peoples. We can see it among social classes. And those dynamics are really crucial in keeping the whole domination system going, because otherwise it could not stand. You know, there would be resistance. But, you know, it's just something very, it's perverse, and it's also very, it's very hard for a lot of people to see. You know,
right.
How that works.
Right. Okay, mother right. What does that mean?
Yeah, mother right. I like this word, and I tend to use it a lot more than matriarchy, because with matriarchy, you wind up in all these arguments over, well, male domination, female domination is just as bad as male domination. And, you know, we're dealing with fundamentally different paradigms. You know, when we're talking about a patriarchal society, we're talking about something that we've seen massive evidence of this happening on the planet. And as I said, it's not universal, but it's, at this point in time, it's almost everywhere. And so that's, you know, this whole thing I was saying about patrilineage and identifying who the sons are so property can be passed on to them, and the ownership of women as chattel and blah, blah. Then if mother right is really a different paradigm, because it is about the right of every human being belonging through the mother line. And the reason this is important is that you don't require any external enforcement to know who you belong to. The blood tie, everybody knows that the woman gave birth. They saw her walking around pregnant, and then there's the baby, and she's nursing the baby, and the child grows up in that clan. And so it's not women over men. It is sisters and brothers, and then you've got the ascending generations and the descending generations, and it's the blood kin tie, and it's not husband-wife. It's sister-brother. You know, that's the tie, and it's much more stable as far as a peaceful relations about how children fare. You know, there can be divorces of love partners, but it doesn't upset the whole apple cart of the continuity of the child's life and the nurturing of the child, because children naturally go with the mother kin, and men belong as the uncles, and they go off to other, you know, to the families of their loved ones, and, you know, will live with them sometimes. Other times they go back and forth. And so you have something that's stable, and it's really egalitarian. But, not but anything. I'm just trying to think of all the things I wanted to cover. Right. The right word, right, is also a word that can be translated as law. In German, Recht still means both right and law. And the same is true in Spanish, derecho, French, droit, all the Indo-European languages. You have this connection of right in the sense of rights, and also the sense of what is right, and in the sense of law. So this really goes together with what we know from, say, Minangkabau people, where their actual name for matriarchy is Adat Ibu, law of the mother. Okay, and that's the social glue. Well, and so we're talking, go ahead.
Yeah, well, they're, in the first place, they're all, one clan lives in a longhouse or the same house. And the women may have lovers, but the lovers go home. Is this correct?
And yeah, you're thinking of the Mostwo. That's the most famous example. In fact, they don't even have marriage.
Uh-huh.
Historically, they did not have marriage. And so, yeah, you know, at dawn, you see the men all heading back to the fields where they're going to work with their sisters. You know,
because they go home to their
mothers. It varies in a lot of different patterns, depending on where you are. Many different models of how that can play itself out.
But basically, the sisters and brothers stay together. That's the clan, not their husbands.
Yeah, that's the social unit.
Yeah.
Is the blood tie, not the legal tie. See, patriarchy is all about creating legal bonds that have to be enforced, because there is not, you know, that's the only way to ensure the father-son tie. You know, to know, if there's a saying in the African-American community, mama's baby, papa's maybe. Because you don't necessarily know for sure who the father is. And so when that becomes the new basis for social organization, then men came up with all kinds of really horrifying ways to punish women and enforce patrilineage by punishing women for sexual independence, you know, for breaking that code of complete female fealty to the male. It was really unilateral. She owed to him what he did not owe to her, according to these codes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's very asymmetrical. You know, it's a power relation. It's a hierarchy.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's many hierarchies. I don't want to get too, I mean, you know, there are, you know, you get into patriarchy. You're also looking at class systems, as you were mentioning earlier. So, you know, these hierarchies interrelate with each other. Racial caste systems, you know, are very much related. They're very much part of patriarchy. And I think this has been one of the mistakes, is people have tried to think about them as separate. But all of these dominations are entangled at the root.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's ways we can talk about that. If we're looking to the origins, then not only are you thinking about, you know, the possibility of raping and capturing women. Those are the early slavery is female slavery. They would kill the men, they would capture the women, you know. But also you are seeing how the other, the warfare against the other, it's okay to do those things to the other. Mm. And this is the roots of racism. You know, It's not just the last 500 years of, you know, the colonial, European colonial world. You have layers and layers underneath that.
Yeah, yeah. I've often wondered what life was like when we creatures honored the Great Mother and the gift of life. How did women and men live in peace together? What was life like?
Well, there's a lot of different ways it's been done, you know, and I'm just still trying to reconstruct that. But one of the things I see is that you have cooperative relations. You have a very strong curb placed on aggression, and that includes rape. That there are societies that have severe sanctions against rape. And Peggy Sande has written about this, among others. You know, and Barbara Mann, who wrote Iroquoian Women,
yeah,
the Gantawisas,
yes,
talks about in the Six Nations people, the Haudenosaunee, rape was just the worst crime. And so they would cast out, you know, the rare cases where that would happen, they would cast the man out. And so then he would lose his kindred. That was the worst thing that could be done to you. And so it was communitarian. So it's not individual property. It is entire kindreds who share the house or the set of houses, and they are sharing food with each other. There's a lot of exchange going back and forth, gift giving, and a sharing of food between kindreds as well as within kindreds. And you have generational layers, so that like all of the women of a certain generation are all the mothers. They're social mothers of the children of their sisters. So that you have kids referring, they don't necessarily even say auntie. They're saying, you know, oh, my mother came, you know, and it could mean their biological mother or it could mean their maternal aunt. And the same way with, you know, the boys, you have the uncles, you know, the uncles are, you know, there are roles for both men and women, but those roles are not rigid to the degree, in most of the cases I'm looking at, that we see in our society, where you've got this very severe boundary around gender. You know, we have to distinguish between sex and gender in this case. And so flexibility around that is, if it's egalitarian, you know, we have to think about the role of sex as well, is one indicator of the more egalitarian cultures. And so, you know, you have women knowing how to do male work very often and men knowing how to do female work. So, you know, I don't agree with those that say that gender is necessarily patriarchy, because I think all human societies are gendered. But the question is, how rigid are they about it, and how dominance-based is it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you think, I mean, what were the celebratory ways or the honoring of the Great Mother and the gift of life? How was this, there weren't church services.
Right, and maybe we, you know, a lot of indigenous people say that, you know, they might not even talk about it as religion, you know,
mm-hmm,
that it's really much more integrated, that there's a whole of the natural world, the human cultural world, you know, the ways that we live in our houses, and, you know, all of the objects in the house, mm-hmm, the weavings, the pottery, the baskets, the pillars of the house. Some Mother Right cultures have pillars that are named after the ancestral mother or carved with her breasts, or walls that are plastered with breasted. In southern Germany, 5,000 years ago, they found clay plastered walls with breasts, and they are painted with white dots. And those dotted breasts show up in Northern Africa as well. Hmm. So there's a lot of cultural themes that grow out of women's work, men's work too for the carving, a lot of things like that. But, you know, in the pottery, they're painting cosmic signs. They're mapping out cosmic meaning in their weaving. And so it's not only symbolic or artistic, it's also spiritual, and it is infused mm-hmm. with life force.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an idea of the flow of consciousness and awareness through everything. Mm-hmm. Everything has soul.
Everything is sacred.
Everything is sacred. And so in that case, you cannot divide the economic from the spiritual. You cannot divide the political from the cultural. It's all integrated. And actually, that's true for us, too, in this screwed up world we're living in, except that it's all happening in a really negative way, you know, but those things are still very much tied together.
Right. I interviewed Barbara Alice Mann, and in her book, Iroquoian Woman, she talked about, I think, the planting of the beans and the squash and the corn, and the women did this at a particular time of the month where this moon was someplace, and they were all together. They were out, and it was this ritual, the planting of it, and
yeah.
honoring the mother and the season and the corn and the beans and the squash. And it sounded
yeah.
just, and I thought, wouldn't that be wonderful? Wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be fun to do that together?
You know, there's another matrilineal people, the Mandan and the Hidatsa up in the Missouri River area in what's now the Dakotas, who had a custom of the women would watch for the birds to return in the spring. And first it would be the geese, and then it was time to plant, I forget the order, corn. I don't remember the order. And then it would be the ducks, and then it was time for the beans. And each thing was keyed to the season, and the messengers who came, these birds were the messengers of old woman who never dies. And she's the one who brought the corn, and she's the woman who danced. She was the one who the women danced for with their staves, and they tied the ears of the actual corn, the corn mother, to the staves, and they danced with them, and they planted them in the earth. And this was all in honor of old woman who never dies.
Hmm.
And they were some of the greatest gardeners in the world.
Hmm.
You know, so farming, seasons, calendrical, relations with bird, the winged world, this concept of the life giver as an old woman, this was all tied together in a whole, and women's ceremony. You know, mm-hmm. these are all related.
Wonderful, really. I'm speaking with Max Dashew. What about those breast pots that are found everywhere?
Well, I see these as ceremonial pots that really celebrate the life giver.
Could you describe them?
Yes. Well, there's different shapes of them, but basically, in some way or another, you have ceramic pots, and they can be molded. Sometimes they're painted, but usually molded. And they can either have breasts all the way around the sides, just protrusion of breasts kind of molded out from the pot, or there can be breast tripods, which you find a lot in East Asia and in the Central Americas region. There are examples from all over the world, and I actually made a poster about this called Breast Pots, which you can see on my website at suppresshistories.net.
Yes.
That has photos from Japan, Iran, all these different countries, Mexico, Tennessee, showing how women in those places molded clay in the shape of the nurturing life giver. And these were used ceremonially. We don't know exactly how. Some of them are 5,000 years old.
Hmm.
Others are much more recent.
Hmm.
Colombia, but Peru. We know this, that they were not just used for, you know, tossing around food and you know, cooking ordinarily everyday food. They were ceremonial. They may have been libation vessels. Maybe they all sat in a circle and passed this around and shared water or corn beer or whatever they had in them.
Hmm.
And so a lot of this archaeology, there are things we don't know or can't know. But there are certain things that we can actually extrapolate from seeing the material culture and the reflection of spiritual concepts in that material culture. That, you know, for example, that they had a symbolism centered, there was something important about the mothers in their culture. And they were expressing this in the ceramics. You know, and I talked before about the wall paintings. There are a lot of ways we can see this in looking at archaeology, at rock art is full of this. And I have a whole series, actually, of these heritages posters. Another thing is vulva stones. And you've got the engraving of vulva signs on rocks literally all over the planet. There is no continent that does not have these. And some of them are extremely old. And so I have a poster showing those, and you have the sacral vulva as a symbol that also comes up in much more recent carvings and paintings in a lot of parts of the Aboriginal world.
Wow.
The Sheilinagig is a well-known example.
Yes, exactly. My goodness, our time is just zipping away here.
Yeah.
We need to talk about your websites and your work and what you're looking ahead to, and you are going to be... speaking at, a Rebel Shamans Women Confront Empires is happening April 6th at 4 p.m.
In Oakland.
Yes.
That's going to be at Humanist Hall, and I have to get that up on my website. I'll have it on Facebook, but that's not good enough. But anyway, that is going to be April 6th, and you can certainly email me at max.shu@lmi.net, and if you want to get that info.
Could you say that again?
Yeah, Max Dashu, and there's no C in Dashu, it's just dashu@lmi.net. LoveMaxInternational.net. That's just the letters. So, that's going to be coming up on Sunday, April 6th, and that's a very interesting show because it is the integration of the spiritual and the political. You know, in the old anti-war days, there was so much fighting over, are you spiritual? Are you political? You can't be both, you know, and there was a lot of division over that. And I think we've come a long way. We're not all the way there yet, but this is a really great example of how the spiritual provides a basis for resistance to oppression, you know, and it's the fact that these medicine women and diviners and female oracles and priestesses are really prominent in the female leadership of movements against conquest and colonization. This is a pattern I stumbled across. I have a slideshow, which is also my other DVD, is Women's Power and Global Perspective. And there's a whole chapter in there about women who led revolts and resistance, defended their countries against conquest. There was a whole pattern I was already beginning to see that some of these women were medicine women. Uh-huh. I thought, well, this is really interesting. And the more I looked, the more of that I found. So there's a whole slideshow now on that.
Wow. Well, tell us where we can go to. You have these wonderful DVDs, and they're beautiful. The art that you have created, collected, and you're also an artist, a wonderful artist, is phenomenal. And what we were listening to earlier, that DVD has musicians from all over, right?
That's. I mean, I worked really hard to get as representative music as I could, as authentic and as much reflecting the cultural realities of the places that we're looking at all these treasures from, you know, these treasures of the medicine woman. And that DVD is called Woman Shaman, The Ancients. And it's actually two discs. It got a little out of control because I found so much great material, I couldn't keep it to one. So it's actually 3 hours. You probably weren't going to sit through it all at once. But people are watching it in stages very often. And, you know, basically I'm just trying to get this images and this information out there that all of this exists because we haven't been shown it. And we really need it. We need it as medicine, as women, We need it as human beings. We need it. We need to reimagine the world as a sacred place and a place that we can actually heal. You know, we can heal ourselves. And so these are our pointers. It's a starting point, really, this video, to look toward the really global expanse, not just the ancient southwestern Asia or the places that usually get looked at, but to really look at, you know, northern Canada and southeastern Africa and Australia and the Andes and all these places that usually fall off the screen when we're talking about comparative religion. And the women, even more so, you know, left out.
Yeah. So where can everybody go to see all of these?
Yeah, go to my website is the best way. Everything is on there. It's www.suppressedhistories.net. Suppressedhistories.net. And so there are links. You can watch trailers for the DVDs. And there's a link to my blog. I have to get a link up about the Facebook page. I've been blogging on Facebook for about 4 years, and I put something up there every day. So I especially recommend the photos section on there because it's a public page. You can just go back there, and you can get an idea of the range of the images that I've been collecting and that I'm trying now to get out there to the world. More, you know, just to really make this available and accessible to everyone.
Yeah, you're doing a real push. You're on Indiegogo, aren't you?
I'm in the middle of a fundraiser in Indiegogo. We have 2 weeks left, and it's called Suppressed History is the Next Step. There's actually a link on my website toward the left of the page. You can click on that, and it'll take you right there. You can see the little video I made about it there and read about it. And what the project, what the fundraiser is for, is that I've got 15,000 slides that need to be digitized. They're all sitting in trays, and you know they can't be shared in that form. That medium is gone. It's over, and so they need to be scanned, formatted, labeled, archived, and then I need to be able to throw them onto web pages and put them into webcasts and videos and all the other things that, you know, are ways of pouring out all of that, all those resources for all of us. So the fundraiser is to fund that scanning and also the massive expansion that I'm going to be doing in the next 2 years of the Suppressed Histories website. Because what's on there now, I have a lot there, but most of the more current material is either on my blog or my Facebook page, and I want to make it all organized, searchable on the website so that you can go through, if you're looking for Zimbabwe, you can find information about women's culture in Zimbabwe, goddesses, shamans, whatever you're looking for. Or if you want to know about patriarchy and the history of patriarchy, you can go through that. So you can either do regional or you can go by subject. And so I need to take all of the material that I've already created and organize it. And to do that, you know, it's a slow process because the archives doesn't have any institutional funding. And so that just slows everything down tremendously.
Yes, I can imagine.
And so that's why we need the funding.
Yeah, yeah. Well, may that be so. That's very, very important. You write, why is it important? It means spreading awareness about the true magnitude of women's contributions and experiences, the structures of domination, archaeological treasures, spiritual philosophies, and much more. This is an opportunity for you to make a real difference in the world. When you donate, you're taking part in spreading knowledge that has been erased and marginalized, liberating images that are medicine for women's spirits. All this will inspire us in creating change. Yes, indeed.
That's the gist of it. Thank you for bringing that out.
Right, right. Now, we're, again, running out here, but switching gears, you will be representing the new legacies of the priestess at the 2014 Australian Goddess Conference in October, which sounds very exciting.
Yeah, they call it the Gaia Conference. And it's going to be in the outskirts of Sydney. And so, yeah, I'm excited about that. I was just there last winter, our winter, their spring. And you know, so I'm coming. I'm going back, and you know, this is. I mean, there's a lot happening. I'm just trying to keep up with all of it. You know, but
yes.
I've created this new show on the legacies of the priestess for a presentation I'm going to be giving in San Diego this weekend. It's a private course that particular showing, but I will be featuring that as a webcast, and so. You can actually sign up to be on my mailing list, and you can look on my website. There's a link there at the left somewhere on the main page. If you want to get notifications for webcasts, I'm in the middle of an online course on Secret History of the Witches, which is allowing me to write my book, finish the manuscript. And so anyway, the webcasts are really the best way that, you know, you and Mendocino don't have to come down to Berkeley to see these visual presentations. You can watch it on your computer, you know. So that's another way that I'm trying to take this large. And, in fact, there are people watching these webcasts on three different continents.
Wow.
You know, so it's I'm trying to get the idea out that this is a way to participate, you know, that you don't actually have to be physically in the same town.
Right.
To see it.
Right.
You know?
No. You have what you have. You gave in the thousands of hits on your website, and
oh yeah, yeah. And the Facebook is over 130,000 at this point. You know, it's just I've been growing it, and it's a really good way to share every day I post something. So this is how I keep growing the information. Also, is to post an image, and I'll put a little short stub about it. You know, a little bit of information. And so all of this is part of, you know, taking all of that and reorganizing it is this expansion of the suppressed history site, the actual website itself and not the Facebook page, that is going to happen. And the long range, I want to make more videos, and I want to get this book out on the secret history of the witches, because I think it's really important for us to understand what happened in Europe, what happened to women, you know, how European patriarchy drove out the priestess and began persecuting women as witches, how European racism evolved out of the diabolism of the witch hunt and the torture trials. There's all these stories that need to be told that we haven't been shown.
Yeah. You know, the state of the world is pretty dismal. It's very worrisome.
It is, and we have to, that's why I think that the medicine aspect of some of the positive information is so important to us, because we can't allow ourselves to get demoralized. And it's so hard, it's so compelling to just be so afraid for the bees and the children, you know, and the trafficked women and all of these things that are going on, and the workers whose rights are being taken away, and, you know, the Keystone pipeline and the fracking.
I mean,
all of that could just drive you crazy, but it's just like we can't afford to get demoralized. We have to be able to renew our hope.
And I think being angry is very helpful in that, to be outraged by what those guys are doing.
You can use that as fuel.
It gives you a lot of fuel, passion.
Yeah, as long as you're not poisoning your blood with it. That's the only thing.
Oh, yeah. No, I say that in a very positive way. I think, yes, rather than just sitting there, you know.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We'd say no more. So anyway, that's my cat little bit there. I want to thank you so much, Max. It's been lovely having you on the show. We're disappearing here in time. And anyway, the best in everything that you're doing.
Thank you, Jane, so much, Janie.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
I really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you. Good night.
Good night.